For the week of May 17th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 279, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Cannes, France, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at the Ed Sullivan Theater in New York City, I'm Michael Giltz.
Are you really at the Ed Sullivan Theater in New York City?
But No, I just wanted to trump you being a con, so I figured I could be at Letterman.
Okay, and now I know why you're there.
Of course.
You've already mentioned it, that David Letterman is retiring after, what has he been doing it now for a couple of years, right?
He's
been
33 years.
Ah, okay, I knew it was something like that. 33 years as a late night talk show host.
That's right. And, you know, that is a signal show for me. It really was. I realize that now. It began in the summer of 1980. I was 14 years old. It was a 90-minute show, and then it became 60 minutes. It was great. It won two Emmys, and then they canceled it.
Wait, what?
And
I didn't know they ever canceled. You mean NBC?
His morning show. It began in the summer, in the morning. It would start at like 10 a.m., I think. And I would go to the tennis courts, the public courts where I was going to play. I'd be driven over there, dropped off. We'd walk into the clubhouse, sit down, and watch the entire show. Every day, 5 days. It was the craziest. I was like, what is this? It was the nuttiest thing. And it really, you know, when it got canceled, I was like, what? Who canceled it? Why? How? And I started to learn about, well, you know, it got great reviews, but housewives were not ready to sit down and watch this weird show. And 90 minutes was weird. And the show was weird. But the network loved him and they still liked him and they wanted to do something with him. And so I started to get interested in scheduling and all that. And then you saw, oh, they're going to give him late night after Carson. That was exciting. Then seeing how that worked out. And I was, you know, a fan from day one. And it was just a great, great show. Those 83 episodes are in the archives, but they've almost never been seen. You can go to the Paley Center, where they have TV and radio. You can go to the Paley Center and see a few of those episodes. But frankly, I'd love to see, I don't know why they didn't do a marathon. I wish he'd had a reunion of the people from the morning show. Not that there aren't behind the scenes people still with him today. That's how, you know, loyal his staff has been. But I'd love to see what that show is actually like.
Now, when you say go to the Paley Center, you mean actually physically go, because there's one in Beverly Hills, Los Angeles. There's another, the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City. So you'd actually have to physically go there. You can't just like get it online, unfortunately.
No, not at all. And by the way, that noise in the background, very exciting when you unmuted yourself there. You're on a balcony? What are you on?
I am on a balcony because all of my roommates here in Cannes, because Cannes is so inexpensive, and I say that sarcastically because it's like one of the most expensive places on earth. There's like nine of us staying here.
but it's the dollar's strong.
The dollar is strong, and that is nice to actually be able to pay €1 and know that it's, for the most part, one U.S. dollar, so that's kind of nice. You don't get home and find out that slice of pizza you just ate cost you $50.
So you are out on the balcony because your roommates are asleep.
Well, Logan Hill from the New York Times, he's here covering for the New York Times, and he is asleep because he woke up at 3 a.m. to watch Mad Men, the season finale, or the series finale, really.
That's right. Not really, but definitely. He did the online recaps for the last season of Mad Men, at least.
Yes. And then we have Eric Cohn, the chief film critic for IndieWire, and Ann Thompson, and Stephen Garrett, our mutual friend Stephen Garrett, who is covering for the New York Observer, and of course of Jump Cut. He cuts trailers. He edits trailers and puts trailers together for motion pictures.
And there will be a trailer film festival, International Trailer Film Festival, in London in October.
Yeah, I wonder if he'll go. I'm going to ask him if he's going to go. And then rounding out our motley crew is Nigel Smith, the managing editor over at IndieWire.
Well, there you go.
But they're all working downstairs, which is very uncommon. At 3:30 it is right now in the afternoon on a Monday. You'd think they'd have better places to be, but I didn't want to disturb them. So I went out on the balcony, and this is the first time ever I'm able to do the show with sunglasses on.
And noise in the background.
Yeah, so that what you hear, of course, conveniently, it's been very quiet up until now, but as soon as we started recording, then all of France came and decided to honk their horns four stories down.
So Mad Men is over. David Letterman is about to be over, but Cannes is ongoing, and that's what we'll talk about this week. What else will we cover?
Well, as you mentioned, we're going to cover the Cannes Film Festival and all that's going on here and some of the films and what's going on behind the scenes. We're also going to cover the television upfronts. These are the announcement of the new schedules for the new season. And really, is there a new season, or is television all year round? We'll kind of debate that. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from this past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilt, who's going to sing about this weekend's box office.
Oh, I have to sing on pitch, I take it.
Yes. You know what? I hope you do it perfectly. Twice.
All right. Well, we're talking about the box office around the world, of course, not just North America. We pull our information from RentTrak. We have a link to them in the show notes. We also pull info from Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, The Avengers, Age of Ultron, by a mile, a country mile, $223 million over the weekend. Thank you, China.
Yes. I mean, that is... I mean, this is not even the first week that it's out in certain territories. It's like the second, third, fourth week in certain territories, certainly in North America.
But it just opened in China to $153 million, the biggest, second biggest six-day opening of all time.
Wow.
Just behind Fast and Furious 7. It could not beat Fast and Furious, but it had a big opening in China. It's at $1.14 billion worldwide. So $1.1 billion. It will get to, looks like, about $1.5 billion before all is said and done. We'll have to see how much longer it holds on. But it's still churning it out. It's about to hit $400 million in North America. It's the highest grossing film of the year, I believe. It did pass Fast and Furious on that level. And it's, you know, chugging away overseas.
One, do you think that Avengers Age of Ultron will surpass Fast and Furious 7 or Furious 7, whatever they've renamed
it? Well, that's going to hit about $1.5 billion too, a little bit more. So it definitely has a shot.
So there's like a race for the number three film of all time.
I guess. It depends how three?
Yeah. I mean, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that Furious 7 is now the third highest grossing film of all time.
Oh, did it pass?
I believe so.
Oh, okay, because number one and two are, of course, James Cameron films, Avatar and Titanic.
Yes.
Right? Those are both over $2 billion.
Well, yes. So I don't see Furious 7 catching up with that.
No. Not a chance of all time. Number three is Marvel's The Avengers, which is at $1.51 billion. So Fast and Furious 7 would need to earn about another $30 million. So it's certainly doable. It grossed $10 million this weekend worldwide. It's obviously played out in most parts of the world. Maybe there's a big territory left. I don't think so. So it's mostly done. It just depends how well it holds on, especially the same with Avengers Age of Ultron. All I'll say is it wasn't very good.
I know that you... I think you've said that already.
All right.
I know that over at Universal, they are pegging it as the number three
They will once it passes it.
Yeah.
Once it's grossed another $35 million, then they can say it's the number three highest grossing film of all time. It's number four right now.
Okay.
So at number one is Avengers Age of Ultron this weekend, $223 million. And number two is Mad Max Fury Road, $109 million worldwide. A strong opening for the Tom Hardy film, directed by George Miller. I did not like the trailer, but the reviews have been just nonstop ecstatic about this. So this movie should have really good legs.
I mean, this is unfortunately a huge box office disaster.
How so?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just reading all of the headlines. I mean, you would think that this movie made no money. And
you're talking about its North American box office.
Yeah, its North American box office was $44 million. Over the weekend, over its opening weekend. It opened against Pitch Perfect 2, so you think counter-programming, one for the girls, one for the boys. And, Pitch Perfect 2, which, you know, is also a sequel. I guess you could call this a sequel as well. It made $70 million. So,
okay, you're confusing us a little bit. Before the weekend came out in North America, the box office people were saying, ooh, it's a neck-to-neck battle between Pitch Perfect 2 and Mad Max Fury Road.
Thank you for straightening that out.
Who's going to win? Oh, my goodness. Then as Friday came up and they could see more and more interest and demand and ticket sales, they were like, ooh, I think Pitch Perfect 2 is going to win. Could it beat Mad Max? Could it beat it? It could ground it into the dirt.
Yeah.
It could kick it in the face. I mean, it totally stomped all over Mad Max Fury Road. In North America, Pitch Perfect 2 grossed $70 million and Mad Max Fury Road grossed $44 million, not even close. If you work in the box office prognostication business, God bless you. I mean, take a magic eight ball, because what's the difference? Why they get paid any money when they can't predict anything? Now, that's not fair, is it? Most of the time, they're pretty on target, I guess.
Yeah, well, because of tracking, and they kind of, you know, yeah, they look at the numbers.
My goodness, how far off could they be? The fact is that Pitch Perfect 2, the first one, Pitch Perfect, did very well at the box office.
But did it gross $70 million at the box office?
Just about total.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I believe it grossed, I shouldn't say, but I believe it grossed $90 million when all is said and done. I'll have
okay,
to look that
then
up
I
right
take
now.
It back. And that's worldwide.
North American. It did great in North America. It had great legs. It got great word of mouth. It did great on DVD. It's a classic example of a movie that sort of built up its audience after opening weekend. It grossed $65 million in North America and $115 million worldwide. So that means the sequel grossed more than the first film did during its entire run, because it did great on DVD and Blu-ray. It grossed $100 million on DVD and Blu-ray in North America. So it matched its worldwide box office. People saw it. They loved it. They rented it. They bought it. It just did terrifically well. So the demand for the sequel was huge. And the reviews are good. Every review basically said it's better than the original.
Oh, I've seen this film, and it's not better than the original. The original was, you know, this is far raunchier than the original. And I let my daughter, well, I didn't let them, but they wound up seeing Pitch Perfect. I will not let them watch Pitch Perfect 2.
Well, you're a good parent. Your child is young. It's not invented for 10-year-old, 8-year-old children.
No, that is for sure.
It's not meant for them.
No.
Neither was the original.
And neither was Mad Max Fury Road.
That's right. So this movie came out. Women showed up again. I have a friend who posts online, and she said, hey, when are women going to prove that they can, you know, do it at the box office? Oh, that's right. Every single year.
Well, and look, Mad Max Fury Road, it's called Mad Max, but the reality is it should be called Mad Charlize.
That's right. It's kind of co-lead role between Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron, who is an action star in this movie, and she holds her own, and there could be a spinoff or a sequel just about her. So the story is not over yet. Pitch Perfect 2 was front-loaded because there are a lot of young women, and they showed up on Friday.
That's right.
But, you know, hey, if it got better reviews and audiences like it, it could have good legs too. But clearly it's already blown past the original. Mad Max should do great worldwide. That has a much bigger imprint, a much bigger footprint.
Although, you know what? You said that it's gotten great reviews, and it has.
Oh, I haven't seen a negative one yet. It was at 100% for a while on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah. And, you know, here there were North American critics who had seen the film in London or in the New York or Los Angeles. So there were critics and journalists here who had seen it, and yet the film screened here in Cannes out of competition, and they went to see it on this big giant screen anyway at the Grand Theatre Lumiere just because they wanted to see it again in that setting. And I can tell you that the international journalists aren't as hot on it as the North American journalists are.
I like the birds in the background. Nonetheless, it's a big, flashy action film. It's a brand name. It will certainly do very well worldwide. We'll have to see where it ends up. It costs more than Pitch Perfect 2. It costs $150 million.
Yes.
We already discussed Furious 7, which is about to hit $1.5 billion. It needs another $12 million to hit $1.5 billion. At number five is Home, the DreamWorks animation film. That's at $350 million worldwide. And at number six is The Chronicles of Evil. This is a South Korean drama. It's about I'm not sure if he's a cop or a detective, but he's had a great career, and he's, you know, celebrating some big night, and he gets a little tipsy, and he takes a cab home, and he falls asleep in the cab, and he wakes up suddenly. The cab is pulled over on the side road in a darkened area, and he's trying to attack him with a knife, and the man defends himself, and he kills the cabbie, and then he decides, well, should I call it in and say, this cabbie tried to attack me? No, no, no. I'm worried people won't believe me. I better cover this up. How does that work out? Not so well.
Yeah, well, you know what? You know, in every movie where that decision is made, it's never a good idea.
That's right. The cover-up is always worse than the crime. And he didn't even commit a crime. So that's the worldwide box office, because once you get past those, we're already down to $6 million for Chronicles of Evil, $6.3 million in opening weekend. So it was all about the two or three big movies at the top, The Avengers Age of Ultron, Mad Max Fury Road, and Pitch Perfect 2. Those are where you made $300, $400 million.
Well, and I should point out, Michael, that 41% of the gross in North America alone, I'm only talking about North America, so 41% of the $44.4 million that Mad Max Fury Road made in North America was made from 3D real D screens only. So only the technology real D, and 3D. So 41%, there's, you know, and we're not talking about Expand or Dolby or any of the other 3D technology. So there's a film where you have at least 40%.
Okay, 40% is the new low.
Well, that's not a low.
So
I mean,
it used to be 70 or 80%. Now we're down to, hey, this did 40%. But again,
That's not a total.
Yeah, I know. But that's my point. Why aren't they telling us the full figures? Why is it they only release select numbers when they have something to say? That's when you know it's all BS. When they only announce it when they have something they want to tout. That means every time they're not touting it, we don't know what's happening. And maybe for this movie, 90% of it is in 3 real D. You know, who knows? You know, but the fact is, unless they tell us the numbers every week consistently and let us see what the total figures are when they're slicing and dicing, oh, but in this format, it was 40, you know, no. What were the ticket sales? How much? Period.
Well, and you know, and
they don't want to tell
us. I have to say, Michael, they still aren't telling you. You know who's telling you in this instance is actually real D. That's how I found out.
Well, of course, there's something to tout. Exactly. Individual companies have something they want to shout about, so they're letting us know what the real D numbers were. But when it's not official and it's not told every week and we don't get that breakdown like we did 2, 3, 4 years ago, every week you could see the total percentage box office from 3D. And they didn't break it down by company and thing and all that. That's because nobody likes it.
And I didn't even know the film was 3D.
It's not. And oh, in fact, our friend Aaron Rich is out in L.A. and he's at USC. He sent me a note about a screening of Mad Max Fury Road that he attended, which he did not like, by the way. They got an email or something that's saying, we have decided to run Mad Max Fury Road in 2D tomorrow, following a suggestion from George Miller's team that the film be presented in that format due to his personal preference. Italics are mine. You will not have to give us your IDs in exchange for glasses tomorrow night. Even the filmmaker doesn't want it in 3D. When he's showing it to film students and wants you to see the film the way it was meant to be seen, the ideal way, he said, no, 2D.
Well, I wish I had known that before he showed up here in Cannes and gave talked to the press, because I would have asked him about it.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. You should have looked at the show notes.
Yes, I should have. I was a little busy.
Oh, well, there is one other film I should mention, because we like to cover box office around the world, and it's an opening in Germany. It's in two territories, so it's Germany, and I'm not sure where the second territory is, but it's Ostwind 2, maybe Luxembourg or something. It's Ostwind 2. It's a sequel to Ostwind, and it's a German family film about a little girl and her horse.
It's actually known as Ostwind 2.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so it means East Wind in English, but Ostwind is also the name of a tank. So I assumed it was some World War II drama, and I look up the picture. I'm like, why is there a little girl and a horse? That doesn't look like a war movie. But no, it's a lovable family film with a touch of fantasy called East Wind 2. And that opened to $2 million in its two territories.
Well, a touch of fantasy is how Cannes opened, at least for me, because I did not make it for the opening night film, which premiered out of competition, La Tête Haute, Standing Tall. People seemed to like it.
It was a very atypical opening night film. It was French, so that's appropriate, but it was a little gritty and low-key and sort of a small indie-type film is the way it felt.
Yes.
As opposed to a glamorous movie with big stars, which is usually what you would go for.
Yeah, it's a story about a boy from age 6 to 18. Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? But this one is a juvenile delinquent. It's not boyhood. And it's about his relationship with the
social system, the
yes.
judge and the social worker and the people who try to save this kid. It sounds like an interesting film. His performance was highly lauded. I look forward to seeing it. So it was a triumph, I think, for an opening night for choosing a small film. At least it did get good reviews. It was not the usual turkey that, you know, would happen in years past. And if it wasn't glitzy, at least it was kind of good.
Yeah, although I would say when I asked people whether they liked it, they said, well, it was better than Grace of Monaco, which opened last year's festival.
well, exactly.
And I thought, well, if you're comparing it to Grace of Monaco, a film that was universally derided, and, you know, then what are you comparing it to? I mean, it's like, you
So
know.
You're at the Cannes Film Festival. How is the weather?
The weather has been absolutely phenomenal, and I will tell you why. On the way to the airport to come here to Cannes, south of France, I stopped and purchased an umbrella. And just by my doing that, it meant it would not rain for 12 straight days.
Yeah, perfect. Well done.
I think actually the festival should have me do that every single year.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're smart, you'll do it for yourself. So there are a couple physical changes. The big main area is the Palais, correct?
The Palais des Festivals, yes.
Right. And it looks like the interior is new. They've done a lot of new different things to the hallways, or what's going on there?
So what they did was when you walk up the Monte de Marche, the big steps that you kind of see in all of the pictures at the red carpet and the red, you know, the staircase. It's all the famous photos from Cannes usually are on the Monte de Marche. You know, once you get inside, there's like a little bit of a lobby, and they basically redid it. So it's all white now, white marble, and it looks like an airport, frankly.
Oh, that's like not good.
You walk into, and they took a staircase out, and instead of a staircase, it's now this winding, spirally, you know, ramp. And inside the theater itself, they took out all the seats and put in all new seats. They are not that much more comfortable. And they are,
really?
Yeah, I mean, they almost are exactly the same. I mean, it's...
Well, they weren't uncomfortable before.
No. They weren't uncomfortable by any stretch of the imagination. But I'm saying, you know, it's not like they put in, like, you know...
Park loungers.
Exactly. they put in, instead of red, they're now blue. So as far as the remodel goes, it's kind of non-news.
Mm-hmm. And to the right of that is where you go to your mailbox and all that. Is that the same?
That's exactly the same. Nothing has changed there.
So it's just the theater section that's new.
That is correct, yes.
Oh, I see. And attendance. Every year we want to know what the attendance is. In North America, of course, Cannes does not have as visible a presence as we would like. It's still like the big film festival in the world, unquestionably. It sets the tone. There's usually one or two Oscar potentials that pop up at Cannes.
Usually when you think about it.
Well, at least, I mean, there's only like 8 films that compete for Oscars, so you're lucky if you have one or two that pop up at Cannes. But there's usually 3 or 4 of the best films of the year appear at Cannes. There's now Hollywood movies all the time that make their presence felt. So it's a fun film festival to attend, and it's hugely important for Europe.
Yeah, that is correct. Very important.
And so we want to know, what's the attendance like this year? We don't mean, of course, fans. We're talking about press, because what matters at Cannes is the people who come to talk about the movies and spread the word to their own markets.
Well, I have not been able to get official numbers yet. I will try to, but it really feels like a down year. I mean, I know at least 10 North American journalists, not including yourself, who aren't here.
Just because they're not here, that doesn't mean that the outlet they used to write for didn't send someone else.
Correct. Although in some cases I do know that they did not send anybody else, in a few cases. I even know some European journalists who have come for many years who are not here this year, and their outlets have not, in at least 3 instances, have not sent somebody to cover the festival. They're just taking it from, you know, a freelancer.
But with 9/11 aside, and the year after that, basically Cannes has always had the same number of journalists, or growing, because there's all these electronic outlets online, websites and things like that. So it always seems like there are people ready to show up.
Yeah.
They're just not from like Le Monde or whatever. Is that the case?
Well,
or does it feel actually less crowded?
It feels less crowded. Now, that does not necessarily mean it's any easier to get into a screening. That does not, because, you know, these theaters, they have 1,200 seats or, you know, 2,000 seats, and you have 5,000 journalists plus everybody else who gets a ticket can go into the screenings. It's not any easier to get into a screening, or in certain cases, some press conferences, but it is not nearly as hectic as it has been in years past.
There are several levels of badges. There is the blue badge, the yellow badge, the blue badge, the pink badge, the white badge. What badge do you have?
I am on a pink badge this year.
Oh, you bastard. Nice.
Yes.
But no dot, no dot.
No, no, I do not have a rosé avec pastil.
Yes, because the pink with a yellow dot is even better. But you have a pink. That's very nice. So that's good.
Yeah, and you know, generally the people with white badges, they write for large dailies. They are critics. They've been coming for a long time. Many years I had the Avec Pastille Jaune. I used to have that when I wrote for another outlet. What that allows you is the ability to work more, because frankly you can stay and write longer, or you can write another piece.
You can stroll up to the screening right before and get in.
Correct, yes. Whereas, you know, with a rosé or a blue or...
Well, please, a rosé, you're going to get into most things. With a blue and yellow is where you're in trouble.
Yes, correct. Yes,
you cannot complain about being rosé. I won't allow it.
Yes. Yesterday, Stephen Garrett got shut out of Louder Than Bombs.
Oh, wow. Was that at the Palais or where was that?
It was at the Debussy, which is the theater directly next door,
It's the second biggest venue.
It's the second biggest venue, yes.
It's a lovely space. I'm not sure how many it holds, but yeah, it can get crowded. I was almost shut out of Wong Kar Wai there. I was like literally on the floor behind the back row. That's how crowded it was. I think I was the last person to get into what was it, 2046?
Yes.
Yeah. That was a crazy nightmare. So he got shut out of Louder Than Bombs. Well, that's miserable. He has a blue badge, of course.
Yes, he does.
Which is utterly unfair. He should have a pink. And
With the amount of writing he does while here at the Cannes Film Festival, he does file daily. And
but they have done a much better job over the last 5 or 7 or 8 years of creating secondary screenings so that the big screening, there's always a next day screening.
That is correct. Yes.
So there are a lot more chances to catch a movie that you've missed. Will there be a possibility he can do that for Louder Than Bombs, or did that not happen?
He could have seen the 10 o'clock. He could have gone today to see it. I think that he just decided to give up on it because the word of mouth on it was not very good. No. And, you know, having seen it, I can tell you it's not a bad movie, but I think the general reaction has been mixed. Yeah, like, oh, okay. You know, stars Gabriel Byrne and Jesse Eisenberg.
And Isabelle Huppert.
And it's a story of a family. And there's a newcomer who plays the youngest son, whose name is completely escaping me now. But it's about a family. Isabelle Huppert plays a war photographer who dies in a car crash. And we quickly learn that she actually died of a suicide, and how the family has been coping with that over the ensuing
but
years.
Co-written and directed by Joachim Trier.
Yes, Joachim Trier is a Norwegian filmmaker whose previous films were in Norwegian. This is his first English language film, and this one is very disjointed. There's no emotional or there's well, really but, no emotional
but
core.
Reprise and Oslo August 31st were also very cool and reserved films, so that shouldn't be a surprise. It's an art film. It's not meant to be a big blockbuster.
Yes.
The kid perhaps is called Devin Druid.
Thank Conrad. You. I wanted to say Droid, but I knew that was not the correct name.
Yeah. Well, it's so, you know, it probably got respectful, polite. But Jesse Eisenberg has a play opening off Broadway, and he's got this movie at Cannes. Was he there?
He was not here, no.
Oh, he wasn't there.
No,
because he's got his play coming out. So you had a press conference for that movie. Is that a competition film? No,
yes, it is in competition.
Oh, it is competition.
Yes.
So how was the press conference?
The press conference was not well attended. Actually, it was interesting, but I would say maybe 50 people, 60 people. I didn't count, but it wasn't a lot.
Well, the press room where they have conferences is pretty small.
Yeah, it can hold if you really want to push it, it can hold about 300 to 400 people.
So it really becomes a madhouse when it's a big movie with a lot of people and everybody wants to get in.
The Woody Allen press conference was standing room only.
Of course. So what was it like? Do you feel like that's a trend where like there are critics there, but they're not even going to the press conference? I mean, what's going on?
I think that, you know, they look at the talent that is showing up and they make their decision based on the talent showing up and whether the movie, they like the movie and they think it's going to do
well. Yeah, but basically if it's in competition, usually it's pretty full.
Yes, correct.
Doesn't matter what the movie is. It's going to be full because you get to talk to a star. Was Isabelle Huppert there?
Yes.
I mean, she's a French icon.
Yes, although maybe because they, you know, it's an English language movie, and she will be starring in two other films that are here at the festival, if not in competition, then in sidebar. So maybe they just decided, well, we'll catch her on the next one.
All right. So the longest film at the festival is The Arabian Nights. It's 6 hours long. It's at Director's Fortnight. I assume you're going to see it.
You can assume away because I'm not seeing it.
That's a mistake.
I know. It's actually 9 hours long, if I'm not mistaken.
I thought it was six, but nine is even more of a reason to see it.
You know what? Maybe it is six. I just know it's in three parts, and it's a huge commitment because you have to go back on successive nights. You can't work successive
days.
Oh,
they don't do a marathon?
No. That would have been, I would have done it. But this is, you pretty much have to commit 3 full days of, you know, not full, but you have to work your schedule around when each part screens. And I thought, you know what? I think I'll wait and see that film sometime in the future, if not never. Although it is getting, you know, people are liking it.
Did you, how can they like it if it hasn't started yet?
It has started. Part one and part two people seem to have enjoyed.
All right. Did we talk about Inside Out on a previous show?
We have, and here's why. We talked about Inside Out. Now, this is the Pixar film being released, I think, soon, maybe even, well, I don't know, maybe in June or May. This is the Pixar film that is about a young girl, and it's what takes place inside her mind.
It opens June 19th in North America.
Okay. And I had seen this film at CinemaCon, as you know.
In pieces.
No, saw the whole thing. And then saw it in I have seen different parts of it in pieces, yes. So saw the whole thing at CinemaCon in high dynamic range, in Dolby Vision.
And wept like a baby.
And thought it was unbelievable. It looked amazing. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to go to the Grand Theater Lumiere here in Cannes just to see how they pull this off. Can it look as good as it did on a, 70-foot screen at CinemaCon? Now,
so they do not have the capability to show a film in high dynamic range yet?
No, not at all. It's that's a big proposition. You need special equipment and a special projector.
They need a special projector for digital, right? They do digital now.
They do digital, but now almost every film is projected digitally. One film this year was not, and we'll get to that in a moment.
Okay.
But it looked good, not as good, but it looked great on that big screen at the Lumiere.
But you noticed the difference, or psychologically you felt like you could tell?
Oh, you could tell, like, in the darks and the whites. Yeah, you could definitely tell. It wasn't as vibrant. It still was beautiful and saturated, but not nearly as, it didn't pop as much.
Okay.
And I wanted to see how this film, this animated film, Inside Out, would play with foreign audiences.
Now, there's and foreign press.
And the, and the foreign press. This was a mixed press and public screening.
Okay.
At 11 o'clock in the morning, and 2,100 people jammed into the Lumiere. And when this film ended, raucous applause. I mean, people went wild. It's that good. People at the press conference, which was not as well attended as I would have thought, they wanted to know why this film wasn't in competition. That question was asked three different times, and no answer was given. It's a film that is that good, that people said, okay, maybe, WALL-E or Up, you don't want to put in competition, but this film deserved to be in competition.
They did. So did WALL-E and Up. They deserve to be in competition, too. You're talking about quality of film.
You're right, and I picked two films that I probably shouldn't have.
So this is a film that we will now say, of course it's going to be up for Best Animated Film, but this is the latest animated movie that looks like it should have a bid to become one of the Best Pictures of the Year nominee.
I really hope that the Academy sees it within their heart to not at least nominate this film for Best Picture.
They'd be lucky to find a better one to win, right?
Yes.
All right. So putting Inside Out aside, because you saw it before, what's been your single favorite movie so far? It's only the opening weekend, so you've only had 3 days, 4 days, really.
Yeah, that only means about 15, 20 movies. I would say there have really been two films that stand out for everybody here. You can ask anybody.
I want to know what you liked.
And I'm going to start with the one I liked best, and that is Carol, which is directed by Todd Haynes, based on a Patricia Highsmith novel from the 1950s.
And it's Howard Stern's favorite movie of the year.
How do you know that?
Because it's about lesbians.
It is Howard Stern's favorite movie of the year. Yes. And it's basically a film starring Cate Blanchett as Carol, the character the film is named after. And Rooney Mara plays Therese, who is an American girl. I don't know why they gave her some kind of odd name. But
it's probably from the book.
But there's a huge age difference there, and Carol is married, so Cate Blanchett is married. And
it's a period piece set in the 1950s?
Yes, it's very much reminiscent of Far From Heaven in that it's about repressed love and desire for, kind of a homosexual relationship at a time when...
homosexual relationship? What are you...
Well, that's what it is.
Two women. Yeah, no, it's not a homosexual relationship. It's two women in love.
Yeah.
Unless you're a preacher, it is not a homosexual relationship.
Okay,
it's two women in love.
Okay. Well, at a time when that would not be construed as something that you could do.
Even today, it's illegal in many states. So there you go. Can't get married in many states. So
true, that's
you don't
true.
Have to go back in time to find a place. So it's set in the 1950s. It's in New York.
Yes.
And it's about the younger woman is a department store clerk.
Yes.
And she falls in love with an older married woman.
Correct.
And Cate Blanchett is married to Kyle Chandler, I take it?
Yes.
Right? And it's just supposed to be terrific.
Everybody loves it. Yes, it is very, very good. Very kind of very slow paced, but not in a bad way, but very deliberate with lush production values, great cinematography. The costumes are fantastic.
Is there a big emotional scene where you can, like, that'll be the Oscar clip for Cate Blanchett? Not that I want you to describe the scene, but is there some big moment of acting?
It's very funny you should ask that. Juicy. It's very funny you should ask that because this film received, rave applause as well at the press screening. Now, Stephen Garrett and I were both at the press screening. And we go out into the hallway afterwards, and he said, I don't get it. Everybody loves this. I don't know. It was just missing a little something for me. And so he starts asking about plot points. Like, well, did this ever happen or did that ever happen? And the people that we were with, we all turned to him and said, what do you mean? That was like the big scene. He goes, well, I'll cop to. I fell apart from between point A and point B. And we were all
fell asleep?
Are you kidding? That was like the climax of the movie. Of course you think it was missing something.
He fell asleep.
Yes. So the big Oscar-worthy moment is when he fell asleep. Now, to his credit, he went back and he saw the last 30 minutes at the screening right afterwards.
Oh, good.
And he came out and he went, ah.
Well, there you go. That helps to see that extra 30 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so that
that was the movie you loved. What was the movie that everybody else is talking about as well?
Son of Saul. Now, this is the movie that was shown on film. I wouldn't be surprised if it was shot on 16mm because it certainly has that aspect ratio of 1:3:3. So kind of a square instead of a rectangle.
And Saul, S-A-U-L, S-O-L?
S-A-U-L.
All right.
And this is a film set during,
it's Auschwitz. It's Auschwitz.
I guess they do say that it's Auschwitz, but I didn't know whether they ever actually pinned it at Auschwitz as opposed to just a concentration camp during, World War II.
Oh, my God. This sounds like the most depressing movie ever.
It's grueling, but I will say this. It's grueling because of the way it's shot, the way it's acted, and what it's about. There may be 30 takes, 30 shots in the whole film because they're very long takes, all in close-up. The whole film is practically shot in close-up. And it's all about this one guy who is the father of Saul, and I'll say nothing more.
Saul is the man. His son is the...
Sorry, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, Saul is the man, and...
He works in Auschwitz. He's a prisoner. He has to cremate, burn bodies.
Correct.
The corpses of people that show up.
Yes. Now, you never really see, you do, but it's all, because the focus is Saul, it's always a little bit out of focus, a little bit blurry when it comes to some of the bodies and some of the graphicness of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really well-made film. That it has packs an emotional wallop and is shot in just such a unique way that between that and Carol, both of those films are what everybody is talking about. Although I should say, there is one other film people are talking about, but not in a good way. Sea of Trees.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is the Gus Van Sant film, stars Matthew McConaughey and Getty and Ken Watanabe, who is on Broadway right now in The King and I.
Which is why he's not here in Cannes, but go ahead.
He's delighted not to be there, and it just got booed mercilessly. People hated it. Ugh. It was like Jerry, but without the homoerotic subtext. What are you doing here?
Yes, precisely. Now, wait, in that case, you could say homoerotic, but I can't... Well, never mind. So that was pretty... The other film that got booed was Mon Noir. Which is by Mei Wen. This is My King. It's a relationship movie. It's not even worth discussing, really. Many people wondered why it was in the festival at all. We talked about Louder Than Bombs. And really, the only other film I should mention is The Lobster, which is by Yorgos Lanthimos, a Greek filmmaker who made another film that you liked very much, Michael, Dogtooth.
That's right. And this movie got good reviews, didn't it?
Yeah, and it's not bad. It's not fantastic. It's not a masterpiece. It's one of those movies you go, oh, that was pretty good. Yeah. You hoped for more and you didn't get it.
Mm-hmm. So pretty good early start. If you have three films that you're excited by, which is Son of Saul, Carol, and Inside Out. Inside Out did not make its world premiere at Cannes, or did it technically?
I guess technically it, It is.
Yeah,
making
it did, because CinemaCon is not. Yeah. So it made it. So that's three damn good movies. That's a good start to the festival.
Yes.
And I have to see, while Son of Saul is about the Holocaust, and that can be depressing, a great work of art is somehow not depressing. No matter how miserable the context or the story is, if it's turned into art, I find that not sad. I find it like Sufjan Stevens has a new album out, which is hugely. I listened to this album and I went, well, somebody died.
Yeah.
This is not a happy album. And then I look up some notes afterwards after I listen to him. I'm like, oh yeah, his mom died of cancer and they had a difficult relationship. So you're like, well, okay, that explains that.
There is one film I should mention. I believe it's screening out of competition. It is a documentary. And it is, I hate talking films up because it just leads to
Well, let's just say it's worth seeing.
It's worth seeing.
You don't have to say it's the greatest movie of all time. Just say it's worth seeing.
It packs such an emotional wallop, and it's called Amy, and it's by Asa.
Oh, well, that's the Amy Winehouse. Yes. Yeah, that's been widely reviewed here. It's the documentary about Amy Winehouse.
And what have the reviews been like back home? Because I certainly haven't had a chance to read them because I've been running around.
They've been positive. They basically say it's fans especially will love it. It's involving. They compare it to the recent Kurt Cobain documentary, which I did not see. And they say it's, you know, it's engaging and involving, and it doesn't paint villains, but clearly her husband and her father, don't come off well. Her husband gets her hooked on drugs and her father seems to enjoy the spotlight too much. Not that she isn't alone responsible for her own death, but it's not simply about, oh, this poor tragic figure. It's sort of somewhat, they say, emphasizes the great talent that she had.
Yes, and there are some moments in this film, and it's such a well-crafted movie. And I know people will have their differences of opinion, and you know, some people will like the way it's crafted. There are no talking heads. It's all told with voices, and you know, you never see the people.
Right. They use found footage, home movies, TV show appearances, you name it, all that stuff.
And the thing is, it's so fresh that we remember when she won the Grammy. We remember when in Belgrade, when she kind of was so out of it, she couldn't even sing. We all raced to YouTube to see that footage the next day of Belgrade.
Actually, I never did.
Okay, well, some of us did.
Yeah, you said on Facebook, you said, we are all culpable for her death, to which I posted, really? What did you do?
Well, when you see the film, you kind of understand why. And
I'm not culpable for her death. I did not read gossip. I don't read gossip pages. I don't follow the travails of celebrities. I do not enjoy the misery. I don't even care about their private life, good or bad. I do not swallow in the misery of other people. I don't read People magazine. I don't read the tabloids. I don't watch primetime television where they talk about the latest nightmare of Amy Winehouse. We discussed her briefly on the show and said we hope somebody close to her will help her, because clearly she's troubled. I mean, she was showing up on tour and collapsing on stage. Clearly the woman was in need. That does not make us responsible or culpable in her death. All I did was buy her two albums. And I liked them a lot.
So you're
That's
culpable.
That's what I did.
You made her a star.
Yeah. We're not culpable. She is an addict. She was sick. She was vulnerable. And she killed. And she died. And it's miserable and sad. And you know, people should have better things to do than wallow in the sad downward spiral of celebrities like Miley Cyrus at one point, or Amy Winehouse, or whomever it may be. But who's responsible is the person themselves. They are responsible, not the world.
Well,
the world is not. There are plenty of celebrities who know how to. It's hard, but there are plenty of people who become world famous, like Adele, and learn and know how to deal with it and say, you know what? I'm not going to enjoy the spotlight. I'm not going to run around and be on the news every day. When you feed the mill, that's when you get caught up in it. Or if you are an addict, then that trouble alone is a different issue. You know, as far as like the gossip and the paparazzi and all that, the paparazzi is horrible. But if you don't feed them, they're going to get bored and they're going to walk away. You know, people don't follow you around if you go to the store and buy diapers. Eventually, they get bored.
Yeah, that's true. I do wonder what you will think after seeing the film, because it does not really dote on making her into a victim at all. It doesn't
well,
do that at all.
Well, that's what the reviews say. But you walked out saying we are all culpable. And I'm like, we're not.
Well,
I didn't say she was a victim, but she's.
I meant the royal we, meaning.
Well, there is no royal we. If she's a victim, if you say other people are responsible, she's not a victim. If you say she is responsible,
see the film and you'll see what I'm referring to by that comment.
Well, it's not a secret. She's dead. Tell us what you want.
No, I mean, it's
not going to cheat anything. Tell us what you
mean. Don't tell me how it ends is what you're saying. I actually use that joke quite a bit to good effect. No, I mean, the way it's shot and the way it's told, and put together, there's a point where you realize that the constant hounding of the paparazzi, we are put in that position.
That's why I don't read any of that crap. That's why I don't any of that crap.
You don't, but the majority of people do. And
well,
so,
no, actually, I don't think the majority of people do. I just think there's an audience for it. Some people watch TMZ. Some people have never heard of TMZ. I've never, TMZ, give me a break. they're hounding people as they come out of the grocery store. Oh, would you buy? Like, go away. I think it's pathetic.
Well, as do I. Yet, in reading some coverage from Cannes in Norway, I see right next to it, something about Kim Kardashian. My thought, what do they care about Kim Kardashian
in
Norway?
Well, Kim Kardashian, that's her job. She wants that. She is feeding that, and she knows how to deal with it, obviously. I don't mean to downplay how awful the paparazzi is, because they are, and they can make a bad situation worse and hound people, and you're a sad person if that's how you spend your life, stalking people outside their homes or taking pictures of their children or doing anything like that. So they're responsible for their own misery. But, she's a drug addict, and was it easier to deal with because there was paparazzi hounding her? No. But
now we're not talking about Kim Kardashian. We're talking about Amy Winehouse, we should say.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I'm sure Kim Kardashian has done drugs, but she seems to be dealing with it fine.
Yes, certainly.
Well, there you go. So the festival is off to a good start. Three good movies, one about the Holocaust. One of the best books I've read this year is The Book of Aaron by Jim Shepard, who's a great novelist. And it's about a kid in Warsaw during the uprising and during the crackdown as the Nazis, ghettoize it off and wall it off. And it's really great. It's really involved. You think, oh, I don't want to read another World War II story. I don't want to read more about the Holocaust. I don't want to read more about Auschwitz. But when it's a great work of art, it becomes, an exciting, thrilling thing. And it really becomes, something you just do not want to miss.
Well, and I think partly the fascination with or the return to World War II over and over and over again was that it was such a brutal war, such a long war, and in a place that we are all now familiar with.
It was not a long war.
Well, we 7 years.
Iraq and Afghanistan,
right?
10 years.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
It's 6 years for the world and 4 years for the U.S., less than 4 years.
That's right. 41 to 45.
About 3.5 years. December 7th, is when the attack was. So you're looking at 3.5 years practically. So, yeah, not a long war at all. But, yeah, it was a world war. Hence, of course, everybody cares. So World War II was a big deal, I guess we would say.
Whoa, I see what you're doing there. You are moving us along.
We all heard that whispering. There's someone on the balcony with you.
Yes, Stephen Garrett came in and literally tried to unplug the computer here while we were in the middle of the show. So you can blame me for not paying attention to the fact that you were trying to transition us to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is, I guess it's about TV ratings. Go figure. Maybe the evening news broadcast isn't dead yet. After all, turns out that three evening news broadcasts, excluding TMZ, grew modestly in their total audience for the second year in a row. Even holding steady would be a triumph, so this is good news for the networks. Their total viewership hit 24 million, a 5% jump, with NBC doing the best of the three, though it was anchored by Brian Williams at the time, which might dim their celebration a bit. Cable news channels were holding steady, that's Fox News, CNN, or they were dropping. But that didn't stop them from increasing revenue. Similarly, the morning news wars haven't hurt NBC. The Today Show lost first place in the ratings, but 2 years later, the Today Show is still making more money. Old habits die hard, even among advertisers. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I think it's CNN actually was dropping. Everybody else dropped except for Fox. So cable news is not doing great. And when you talk about paparazzi and tiresome media, 24-hour news channels are right at the top of the list. Anytime there's any event, they pound it into the dirt. It's just annoying. I don't know why anybody watches 24-hour news anymore, because even when there's breaking news now, they make it so tiresome that you don't want to watch.
I agree.
breaking news. They have absolutely no breaking news, but every half hour they keep touting stuff. and they have people on there discussing what might have maybe happened or what might could happen or what possibly might happen in the past or the future based on things that they're just guessing.
That is true.
That's how they cover news events. Have people just, you know, rattle off ideas. Well, you know, maybe it was the brakes. Maybe it was a pebble. Maybe it was a terrorist attack. I don't know why that train derailed. But anyway, so I think it's interesting. I think what really caught my eye was how the Today Show is still making more money. What the heck?
That is kind of surprising.
It's like, guys, Good Morning America's been winning. Why aren't you putting your money 2 years? I don't understand that at all. That makes no sense to me.
Well, now here's a story that it's a follow-up to a follow-up to a follow-up, right? Oh my gosh, are you doing them? You know, there are copyrights that we will have to adhere to. So try to do it a little off-key because then we could say, you know, it's fair use. This is Twin Peaks. David Lynch, he was in, then he was out, now he's back in. He's going to, I guess, he returned to Showtime and they, you know, Showtime had asked Lynch and Frost to kind of cut back on the budget as or I guess they asked him to take less money. I don't know what happened, but David Lynch is back.
That's right. This is the story. Now Showtime people are saying, hey, look, they turn in scripts and those upped the budget considerably for what we were proposing. And so they went to them and said, hey, can you trim your profits as a concession? Because, you know, it's going to cost us now a lot more money to do this. And Lynch balked and walked away. That's how they portray it. And they say one of the big problems was that David Lynch doesn't have an agent or a manager right now and didn't talk to his lawyer before announcing he was walking away from the deal. Right?
Okay.
So they're blaming it on that and say they're trying to divert attention away from him and say, no, don't blame David Lynch. Or the implication to me slightly, I don't think intentionally, is, well, you know what? You can't walk away. That was the impression I got when they say he didn't talk to his lawyer, but he professes to be happy now. They profess to be happy. They're going to do more than 9 episodes, and he will direct them all. So I hope he got the money that he thinks is needed to do the shows properly. I'm glad he's back. Nobody wanted to see this happen without both David Lynch and Mark Frost on board. So thank God that's happening. Whether they'll do 10 or 12 episodes, I don't know. But all right, thank God the stars have aligned, and Twin Peaks will happen the way it should.
Now, I wonder if anybody wanted to see more episodes of The Mindy Project. I believe Hulu thinks they do because, what was it, Fox canceled the show during the upfronts. They, you know, they said next season, no more. However, Hulu has picked it up for 26 episodes.
Right. I mean, they've said, look, we want enough to get this syndication. So that's what we're going to do. So when Hulu said, we'll make a deal, they said, don't do one season and then wait, you know, just give us 26 episodes. We'll give it to you all at once. Everybody will be happy. And they know that they'll have enough to do. And if it works, maybe they'll go beyond that. But what was interesting here was that Mindy Kaling refused to see the show as ending. Like, clearly it's been on the bubble since day one. It's never been a big hit. It's a very modest show as far as in the ratings, but it's steady. It never dropped. The audience that watched keeps watching, and I'm sure it's an urban, sophisticated, educated, wealthy female audience. You know, I mean, I'm sure that's who their dominant thing is. And while women are easier to reach than men, it's always good to reach wealthy people with lots of money. And I'm sure the Mindy Project has great demos. But when Fox third season, she said, no, I'm not going to engineer the season finales if the show is over. I refuse to admit the show is done. I'm going to just let the show continue on. There's going to be no sense of completion whatsoever. I refuse to believe this show is going to die. And she was right.
Well, you know, she was actually in Cannes earlier today for Inside
Really?
Out. Yeah, well, she stars in, well, she's one of the voices. I think she plays Disgust, actually, in Inside Out. You know, I had asked a question at the press conference already, so I didn't get a chance to ask about this news. But, of course, as you know, Michael, they frown upon you asking questions about non-film-related
Right.
projects. So I didn't get around to it, but I would have liked to have known what she said. What she did say is that she kind of realizes that given the way she just said, look, for an actress like me of my persuasion, I will be writing my own material. You know, I don't get called out on a lot of auditions. I'm not the big leading lady. I'll be writing what I act in.
Uh-huh.
For the most part, which was her surprise at having been called for to appear in, or at least vocally appear in, Inside Out.
Ah, I see what you mean.
Yes. Now, you mentioned that Mindy Kaling refused to give up, but I guess Bill Simmons, well, he didn't really give up, he just got fired.
That's right. Technically, they didn't renew his contract, but in the real world, we would call that being fired.
Right.
Yeah, Bill Simmons is a mainstay at ESPN. He oversees Grantland, which has been a huge successful website for them, a property that looked sort of quixotic at first. He's turned himself into a name brand while being with ESPN and partnering with them, helped launch Grantland, had his own column, was a big controversial figure. You know, ESPN thrives on people, you know, making controversial statements and arguing with each other and, you know, having debates about this team and this sports issue and that sports issue. But they were not happy with Bill Simmons, and they finally said enough is enough. You know, he had challenged the NFL and challenged Major League Baseball and challenged, you know, this, that, and the other person one too many times. And so they just finally decided they weren't going to renew his contract.
Right. Well, and maybe he was a bit right in challenging the NFL, as we are now all seeing, but that's another story entirely.
That's right.
Okay, so now...
So I think it's a big deal, though, because they really built up his value, and now he doesn't need them as much as they perhaps need him.
That's true. Now, I'm moving over to the UK for a moment here, because the BAFTA TV Awards were held. They came out, and they're kind of a great indicator of which UK shows we should all be looking out for around the world. Winning Best Drama was Happy Valley, a cheery little show about a female police sergeant just recovering from her daughter's suicide when she spots the man she believes raped her daughter, driving the poor girl to suicide. Needless to say, she becomes obsessed with following him. Fun.
Okay. It sounds like one of those shows like the David Tennant show, where it feels like a complete story in one season, but they have renewed it for a season two. I believe it's probably going to be a new tale. I think it's self-contained this season. You know, it's a season-long arc. But yeah, the BAFTA Awards is a great way to find shows that you are excited to watch, like the best comedy, which is Detectorists. And it's a comedy about guys who do metal detecting. You know, they have those little machines, but they also want to be detectives. So they look for metal and precious things, but they also want to solve crimes. I don't know how that comes together. But it's written, directed, and starring Mackenzie Crook of the original UK Office. He played Gareth. And he's a terrifically odd actor. And I'm really excited to see the show. It's his baby. And he's from The Office, and it won the BAFTA for Best Comedy. I really want to check it
out. What about the Best Miniseries, which went to The Lost Honor of Christopher Jeffries, because that title is not too long. A drama.
Well, and it's perfect for our discussion of The Paparazzi.
Ah, okay. Well, that's true, because it's based on the true story of a retired school teacher suspected in the murder of a tenant of his... one of his tenants, and vilified by the media for fitting the bill of eccentric weirdo so nicely.
That's right. It's basically a man hounded by the press.
I don't mean
to say people can't be hounded by the press, but his life, you know, essentially was destroyed for many years because they decided he was the villain, even though the cops released him and said he was not, you know. And eventually, of course, they found the real killer, thank God. And so his nightmare abated somewhat, but it really was a case study in the media just deciding, you know, it's like a cry in the dark with Meryl Streep. You're not behaving the way we think you should behave, and therefore we're going to paint you as a villain.
And wait a second. You know, did he ever say a dingo ate my baby?
I don't believe he did.
Okay, just checking. And
of course, we're all trying to watch this stuff online or waiting for it to come to America. And that ties into the fact that BBC ended their discontinuing their player that people used to watch their
the
shows.
The iPlayer
on.
Is what it was
they're
called.
They're discontinuing it internationally. Ooh. And I guess they're going to replace it with something new. But people are a little worried that maybe they're cutting back or whatever, because that thing is hugely popular around the world.
Well, maybe they're just moving one letter down to the J player.
Maybe so.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, you know, Graham Norton won Best Chat Show, and Ant and Dec won for Best Entertainment. And True Detective won the International Award over at the BAFTA TV Awards.
That's right. Ann and Dec have sort of a variety show. It's called the Saturday Night Takeaway, with fast food, takeout food. So Ant and Dec's Saturday Night Takeaway. And I'm really wondering if Neil Patrick Harris has watched this show, because I feel like it would be a great model for what he might want to do.
And we're going to be getting to that in just a moment. But I do wonder if, I guess they really don't watch American Idol in the UK. Or
they watch UK Idol, or, you know, they watch The X Factor, you know, now.
Well, you know what? We won't be watching American Idol. That's for sure.
We will. There's one more season left.
Well, I meant, you know, after they call it quits, which is this season.
That's right. The next upcoming season will be the last. I'm sure all the original judges will come back at some point to say goodbye, maybe the finale or during the season. It's a shame they couldn't get the three original judges to get together for one more season. Of course, how do you tell the people who were on there. Now, by the way, move to the side. We want Randy, Paula, and Simon. But I think that would have been the best way to go out as far as in the ratings. But boy, talk about, you know, pulling the plug not a moment too soon. This year ended when they hit the top 10 is usually when the ratings go up. And this year, that's when the ratings went down.
Oof.
The farther along the show went, the more it dropped out of the top 10. It just, you know, it's fallen off a cliff. So they're not ending it, you know, anytime too soon. That's for sure.
Well, now, just because we're running long, and I know we want to get to some television news with the upfronts, I assume you believe that's a big deal that American Idol was canceled.
Absolutely.
Well, what about this? We talked about the Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao fight and the pay-per-view and the Paris.
$500 million.
$500 million in the space of what, like 5 hours? So what do you think? Is that a big deal or a big whoop? That's how much the pay-per-view made, that whole event made on television, $500 million.
I think it's not just that. That's also the gate. That's everything. But it's the highest grossing of all time boxing match. Absolutely. So they pulled in over $500 million in revenue.
I wonder if there'll be a rematch.
Well, I mean, no, I don't think so.
Maybe not. What about losing Harry Shearer? Now, you might say, what? What is that in reference to? Harry Shearer plays a voice, several voices, on The Simpsons and has for 20-some-odd years.
Like Mr. Burns.
Yes. Excellent. $14 million a year he was being paid, and he's walking away because he says that at the new contract, the same contract, by the way, that Fox says was offered to everybody, or Gracie Films says was offered to each one of the vocal stars, the voice stars, he says the new contracts wouldn't let him do outside work the way that he always has. And so he walked away. They say, hey, guess what? We're going to recast you.
I find this very upsetting and unpleasant. I feel like we don't know the full story. It's bizarre.
I agree. I think we don't know the full story, and maybe at some point.
He said, look, I've always been able to do outside work. Now they're saying I can't. I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would they change that? Why would they care suddenly? You're 26, 27. But that's what he says, and they haven't really responded to that. All they said was, we gave him the same contract everybody else had, and we were offering him $14 million a year, which in their wet mind is to say, hey, you can't say we were being cheaper or screwing him out of anything, but in my mind makes me think, well, he must have some other good reason then. They've had their fights before, not Harry, but the entire cast, about how much money they make, because this is a wildly profitable franchise, though at this point I don't know why it's still profitable.
I can't imagine. I mean, $14 million, I guess really when you think about it, they need all that merchandising, must pay for itself.
Yes, because and keeping the show with new episodes, I guess, keeps the merchandising fresh, because clearly they have, you know, three times as many shows as they need for syndication.
That's
four
true.
Times, five times. You can only strip so much. At some point, TV shows have diminishing returns. That's what it's all, you know, it gets too expensive, and therefore it's not worth going on further, because you've already got all the shows you need in order to strip them 5 days a week.
That's true.
On this show, all the rules are out the window. They're animated characters, so they don't have to get too old, so you don't have to worry about that. And it's a worldwide property, and there's the merchandise, and I guess the toys and the spinoffs stay fresh thanks to the show, and that's what's powering this puppy. And that's why the cast is getting, you know, $10 to $15 million a year, you know, 26 years into the show. So I'm not sure exactly why he left. He says it's for that one reason. They haven't really responded. It makes no sense. I find it sad.
In ending here, Idina Menzel, she is going to tour in the Broadway show that she starred in, the musical that she starred in, If Then, which you said, Michael, was not very good. And so when they said, oh, it's coming to Los Angeles, I said, oh, well, even though my friend Anthony Rapp is in it, he's probably not going to come to Los Angeles, so I'm not going to see it, because even Idina Menzel isn't going to be in Los Angeles. Guess what? She is going to be in Los Angeles. She's touring with the show. Should I go see it?
Should you go see it? No, I don't recommend seeing it. I don't like the show, but I do like the fact that she is sticking with it. Very often Broadway stars don't tour with their shows. It happens sometimes, but usually it's somebody new, somebody different. And I think she really feels a commitment to the people who back the show. I mean, she stayed with it for over a year, and I think she knows she's going to launch the tour. She's not going to be with the tour the whole way, but she's going to be with it the first 3 months, from like December through March or something like that. And then somebody else will be cast and take over the part. And I think she wants to give it a more chance to become profitable. You know, Broadway shows, it didn't turn a profit on Broadway. And she knows that if she's in it, that she will draw people. And so I think she's trying to help them get over that hump. And I think she's a real trooper. you know, obviously she loves the part. She loves the role. It's all about her. You know, she got good reviews herself. So, you know, there's that. But I really think this is about her trying to show good faith for the people who backed the show. And in that case, I think it's a big deal.
Well, in that case, we should probably move on to Inside Baseball, just because we're running long. Now, Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. You may have noticed over the past week or two a lot of news about which of your favorite television shows were or were not coming back in the fall. But my question for you, Michael, is, and by the way, the reason that is because all the networks and the cable networks and the Hulus of the world met in New York City, and they have what are called upfronts, and that's when they're introducing the new shows and the existing shows to all the advertisers and saying, please purchase all of your advertising upfront, buy it today, because in the fall it may be too late.
And that doesn't happen as much anymore, does it?
No. My question is, isn't TV year round? I watch Orange Is the New Black whenever a new episode appears.
That's right. I mean, the idea of, even now we have the upfronts, and I think there's a bit of a de-emphasis now on people buying all their ads up front. I don't think that happens as much anymore.
It still happens quite a lot. I mean,
they still pull in a ton of money, but I think with, you know, there's a lot more emphasis during the upfronts on, look what we're going to do in midseason. Look what we're doing during the summer. Look at all these different shows we have. I just think it's much more of a year-round business. And I think the trend has to be down. I don't understand why you would want to buy all your ads up front, you know, in the fall, you know, before you've seen anything. To me, it doesn't make any sense. And I think that old way of doing things is still sticking around, and it's got 5 or 10 years in it. But I think 10 years from now, it's just got to be a different beast.
Well, I wonder that maybe it's Orange Is the New Black and House of Cards or Breaking Bad or Mad Men. Don't Tell Me How It Ends. I haven't seen it yet. Where is all the comedy?
Well, there's very little. Well, Orange Is the New Black is sort of a comedy. People would say so.
Yeah.
But comedy is in short supply. That definitely was the big news. Very few comedies being picked up by the networks, very few on their schedule. NBC, for the first time since 1980, I think, has no comedies on Thursday night.
Maybe that's because they're doing too many remakes, reboots, and spinoffs.
Well, are they or are they not? I mean, that's you think it's what you got a problem with that? You don't want to see Heroes Reborn? You don't want to see Twin Peaks?
I don't know. I just want them to put a little thought into it.
Well, yes, but I mean, it's nothing new. You know, they've always had remakes. They've always had reboots. They've always had spinoffs. Movies have done it since movies began. TV has done it since TV began. There's always been game shows, reality, you know, shows that spin off sequels. And it's always gone on.
You know what? Actually, I blame Harry Potter because, you know, the first book was such a hit. Then they did 9 more books. And now everybody wants like spinoffs and remakes and sequels.
There were 7 books of Harry Potter, and it was one long story, and you leave it alone.
Fine. Well, why can't they put all those spinoffs on, like, you know, Hulu?
Well, they can.
Well, what happens when they, you know, quite honestly, when you look at, what was it, which one of these, Community was on Yahoo? We have the Mindy Project on Hulu now. It looks like all of these web outlets or online outlets, these OTT outlets, are kind of riding to the rescue.
They're the new HBO. It used to be for years, they'd say anytime a show was being canceled, they'd say, maybe HBO will pick it up. And they did it like once, I think.
Then it was Netflix, remember?
Right. And then it was Netflix. So it's always, well, it was PBS for a while. And then there were other channels like Showtime. And so pay-per-view channels, not pay-per-view, but pay TV. Wow. Now I've got a drill in my place. Do you hear that?
No.
Wow, okay, there's a big drill going on next door to me. So now there's so many more outlets that when they announce shows aren't coming back, they still don't say the show is over. Almost every show that was canceled that was early in its run, you had the people saying, we're in talks, we're talking to people, and you know what? It's not just hot air. They really are looking at places because there's a lot more outlets that need a show. And if you've got a niche audience, if you've got some fan base, that's going to pay off for a basic cable channel or somebody like Netflix or Hulu, and they're going to make it profitable for them.
Now, you mentioned Neil Patrick Harris earlier. Why is that?
He's got a show on NBC. He's got is it NBC?
I don't know.
He has a variety show on network television. Actually, I think it's CBS now. I'm not even sure what night it's on. But Neil Patrick Harris has a variety show, And that's one of the shows I'm most excited to watch. I'm not sure what he's going to do. Ellen DeGeneres also has a variety show coming out. I think that's with Steve Harvey she's partnered with. He's going to be the actual on-air host. She tried to do a variety show, a special once or twice. I think it was on TBS. That was a little while ago. Or was that Rosie O'Donnell? The fact is, lots of celebrities love variety shows. And there's all sorts of variety shows on network TV. I mean, American Idol and America's Got Talent. I mean, those are variety shows of a sort. Dancing with the Stars. You know, some of them are just one particular type of variety, of one particular type of performance, but they are akin to the old classic variety shows. So he's got a big show. It's called The Best Night Ever. And it's going to be fascinating to see how well it works.
Well, I think The Best Night Ever is Saturday.
Saturday when there's no television?
Yeah, because there's no television. I get to catch up.
Yeah, I don't understand it. I mean, with DVRs, it seems like it doesn't matter what night a show airs on anymore. And yet all the networks have abandoned Saturday night. They've now found huge success on Friday night, which they were starting to abandon. But now you've got a top 10 show with Tom Selleck and Blue Bloods. You've got other shows doing well. You've got ABC establishing their Friday night sitcom again, which they had given up for years. And I don't get it. Saturday night is just basically reruns. They got overruns of college football and pro football from the afternoon. And they've got some sporting events. But basically, they just ignore the night. Why give up all that real estate? I don't understand it.
Well, the biggest night is Thursday.
That's right. Thursday is where there's the most competition. And it's the night where I think every network can win to a degree. ABC, of course, has Shondaland. You've got, you know, all Grey's Anatomy, you've got Scandal, and you've got How to Get Away with Murder. And that did great for them last year. CBS has football for your weeks, and then they've got Big Bang Theory, which is the number one comedy in the country. Fox has Bones, which is certainly, you know, showing its age along with Sleepy Hollow, but they're going to have good demos, and Bones has a new showrunner. CW also has some shows that are long in the tooth, basically The Vampire Diaries and The Originals. But again, that's going to have its core audience. I think those two are a little weaker, but ABC and CBS have big stuff. And NBC has Heroes Reborn, leading into The Blacklist, leading into a new show with Wesley Snipes. Now, The Blacklist at 9 o'clock had nothing on that night, nothing before it, nothing after it. It was literally abandoned on Thursday nights. And yet it still, towards the end of the season, was beating Scandal. That to me was amazing. That to me was the big story of the year. So now with Heroes Reborn leading into Blacklist, and I think lead-ins still matter to a degree because it gets people to pay attention. And if you're taping, you know, it's like, yeah, sure, you're not there watching it live. But when you set up your taping and you tape Heroes Reborn and you're taping The Blacklist, you go back, oh, Heroes Reborn, I think I'll check that out. They do help each other that way. You see them on the grid when you're setting your DVR. So I think The Blacklist, which was beating Scandal by the end of the season last year, it's going to have an even better year next year.
Well, now you told me earlier that you are glad that Forever was canceled. Why are you glad that, I mean, this is what, like a fantasy type show, right?
This was Ewan Griffin starring as a man who's lived forever. He can't die.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He's been cursed or blessed, and now he can't die, and now he's died. The show has been canceled. But I don't care. I'm happy. I mean, I like Ewan Griffin, but I want him to make more Horatio Hornblowers. This was one of the great series going on. It was a series of TV movies, and they were adapting the Hornblower books. And the great thing is the books chart his career from a young midshipman all the way to his retirement, you know, decades later. And now they were happy making the shows, and they were adapting each book into like two or three TV movies. So they were basically miniseries, like 6 hours long or 4 hours long for each book. And they'd done like the first three or four or two or three, because the first book has multiple stories. And they were doing great, and they were wonderful, but they were expensive. But they won Emmys, he got acclaim, and they had to stop them, even though he didn't want to. They had to stop for a while, and he's been trying to reboot the series and make some more Horatio Hornblowers. And the great thing is, he's exactly the right age for it now, because the middle books that they'll be doing now, he's aged 20 years, you know, in real life. So it's perfect. It's like the 7-Up of TV dramas, you know. He'll actually be the right age to do this character now. And they can do a couple more books, and then they can take off another 20 years, and then they can do Admiral Hornblower at the end. So it's going to be, I hope and believe, that he'll make this show happen again, because it was a great series. It did great numbers. It was hugely acclaimed. There's got to be somebody willing to make these Hornblower movies again. And Ewan Griffin is ready. He's available. And he's the right age to tackle the middle career of Horatio Hornblower. And when all is said and done, it should take them like 40 years to make this show and do all the books in the Hornblower series. But he'll be the right age at every step of the way. And that's never been done on TV before. And that's going to be really, really cool.
And you know what will wind up happening is that it will be nominated against for an Emmy or some television award against some other series and still won't win.
What?
That was a reference to Boyhood. You know, look, at the end of the
day, because Hornblower won Best Miniseries.
I know, I'm just kidding. Couldn't remember what won Best Picture this year. That was my joke would have been much funnier if I could have remembered the it wouldn't have been much funnier, but it could have been. In any case, a great show that I always loved was The Muppets. If they're gonna do remakes, they should remake that one.
When they are, of course. And it was bizarre. They said it's a more adult Muppets, and I'm like, what? Like, whoa. What are you talking about?
Wasn't that Avenue Q? I think I saw that.
Yeah, that's not what they quite meant, but it's close. It's closer to that. It's not racy or anything. It's still family friendly, but it is in fact like backstage and the private lives of the Muppets. And I thought, what the heck? That sounds ridiculous. But you know what? They showed long clips from it, and I have to admit, it was really damn funny. I was kind of like, wow, that looks kind of awesome. So the two and a half minute clip I saw from the Muppets, you have like a woman dating Fozzie Bear, and she's with her parents, and they're like, but honey, how will it work? Where will the children go to the bathroom? He goes, that is a horrible stereotype. So I don't know where they're going with this, but they're putting on a variety show, and it's the backstage lives of the Muppet characters. And it seems to be spoofing reality shows and like The Office, docu-spoof. And I don't know. The 2.5 minutes I saw were hilarious. And by the way, the movie that won Best Picture was Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance.
I've got jet lag. I'm exhausted. I can't remember my own name now. How am I supposed to remember Birdman?
Yeah, so that's why they have the upfronts. They can show clips. They can get people excited about their shows. They can get us talking about mid-season. They can get us, excited for shows that are coming out 6 months from now. I had a lot of talk about shows that were opening in January, February, and March, because they know that television is now year-round. There's a lot of superhero shows, a lot of reboots, a lot of remakes, but the networks are still making money, and so they're happy.
Well, unfortunately, somebody who is not making... Well, no, actually, I take this back. He probably is making money now. Unfortunately, it's posthumously, is B.B. King, who passed away or died at the age of 89 from complications with diabetes.
That's right, and do you know what B.B. stands for?
You better be king. I don't know.
Well, it's blues boy, really. He started off as a DJ, and he was the Beale Street blues boy, and then he just became blues boy, and then became BB. So that's how he got his nickname. And, he's easily the most important blues man of the post-war. There's nobody else. He's number one, two, and three. I don't think there's anybody else even close. And he had a string. He had like dozens, 40-plus hits on the R&B charts before he finally broke through on the pop charts with his one top 20 hit, which is, of course, The Thrill Is Gone. And thank God for that, because that sort of helped the Twitter write itself. When you wanted to tweet that B.B. King was dead, all you had to do was say, The Thrill Is Gone.
Oh, that's true.
I think I saw that about 500 times. But, he had a lot of singles on the R&B charts, not a lot of best-selling albums. When I look through his credits, I think maybe that some of those old blues albums simply haven't been certified yet, or there must be some greatest hits package that hasn't been certified yet. But as I think about it, there is no really defining compilation of B.B. King. I mean, there's box sets and there's this and that stuff, but a really great greatest hits album can really help an artist and become that one album that you buy. And I think B.B. King, like a lot of people, he was on a bunch of different labels at certain times, and he got packaged and repackaged. So you'd find his hits packaged and repackaged. So you've probably got like 10 or 15 or 20 different greatest hits sets, and they've all sold a couple hundred thousand copies. And so you don't have that one album that everybody knows they need to buy by B.B. King. His one album that is certified for even gold is, in fact, a duets album with Eric Clapton called Riding with the King from 2000. Great album. And that went double platinum. So that was late in his career. That was pretty cool to have a really big selling album at that stage. And I wish there was some one single CD great thing that I could say, that's the one to buy. But there isn't. There's about 20 of them, and they're all about the same.
In 1994, I was working in New York for a company, and company was in the lobby of their building. There was another company holding a party, like a corporate
event. I like how vague this is.
Well, I
was working at a company, and there was another company, and they had a party.
It was Philip Morris was the company. I wasn't going to name the company. It was Philip
That's
Morris.
That's who you worked for?
Yes.
Yeah. Ah, now we know why.
Yeah. Hey, I am in France, okay? Watch out. You know, there are people who are going, what is Philip Morris? And they're going to have to go look it up.
Everybody knows.
Okay, well, they Mad Men did just end. So, you know, the company next door in their lobby, and I could see it from the lobby of Philip Morris, they were holding a corporate event, and I guess they had hired B.B. King to be like the entertainment for the for the evening.
Sure.
And it was like the cocktail hour, and, you know, they were like, okay, well, we have to, you know, mingle a bit and talk, so maybe you just stand here for a while. And he was just standing in the corner. B.B. King, just standing in the corner, doing nothing, holding his guitar, and should've nobody was talking to him. Nobody was looking at him. And I just thought to myself, are you kidding me? This is B.B. King in the... You put B.B. King in a corner? Unbelievable.
Well, it was not an insult, you know, I mean, in the sense of, you know, the working the event, the guy was famous for doing, I mean, 1 year he did like 300, almost more of more shows than there were days in the year. In 1 year, he did like 340 shows 1 year. So he was tireless, even into his 70s and 80s. He was doing hundreds of shows a year.
I think his last show was in October. Of last year.
No, he did it right up until the end. So, you know, this is a guy who, you want me to work? Sure, I'm ready to work. It's what I do. But, you know, a brilliant guitarist, one of the great guitarists of all time. You can recognize that stinging sound from a mile away. He influenced everybody who came after him in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, in the Blues Hall of Fame, and buy one of the many thousands of compilations that are out there, and you won't be disappointed.
And hopefully you weren't disappointed in this week's show, which you can subscribe to in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher. And we do urge you to subscribe to the show and to rate and review it in any podcast aggregator or podcatcher, whatever they're called now on the mobile phones. Although, you know, if you are disappointed, please don't tell us. No, actually, you should tell us. You should write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, I know a lot of you have sent some email in. We are going to try to get to some of them next week. It's a little hard to do that while on the road.
Links, so we are having a show next week?
Yeah, well, I'm going to try. Yeah.
All right.
Links to all of the stories we've discussed, as well as links to all of those ways to contact us or subscribe to us or follow us. We're on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our username. Or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox, and that's where you'll find our page. All of this information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, which is at whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, you have a website every week. It's something new and exciting where you're either writing about the entertainment industry or posting about. What is it this week?
This week it is thethrillisgone.com.
Which I'm sure is already owned by somebody. So you know what? If you can't find Michael's...
Well, you know, actually, I always look it up to see if it's available or what it is. And of course, this one is available for sale. And it's domainmarket.com. And they say you can buy it for $25,000. And I'm going to guess that about a week ago, it was about $5,000.
I would tend to agree with you.
They're like, whoops, mark that sucker up.
Well, you know, if you can't find any of Michael's entertainment writing there or his coverage there, try michaelgiltz.com, head on over to the Huffington Post, or maybe even try bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.